is the session on, by the way, can any of you hear me? Is this on?
It's on, but just barely.
It's on, but just barely. Okay. I'm assuming that the presenters will either speak out loud or the gentleman who's going to take care of the recording will come in pretty quick. My name is Kirk Linford, and I've been asked to be the chair of this session. Again, it's Obedience Culture, Churches, and Their Impact from Guantanamo to California's Proposition 8.
Thank you.
A little bit of housekeeping here. If you do have a cell phone or other type of noisemaker, high-tech gadget, would you please disable it right now so we don't enjoy its ringtone later? This, by the way, is the session that should give us some therapy for those of us who have a twinge of guilt as we listen to alternative voices and attend symposia. So this will help us on that journey. Our two presenters today, the primary presenter will be Dr. Glenn Cornett, who hails from the epicenter of technology there in Palo Alto. I didn't quite understand what his company does. He might share just a little bit of that. And then he will be followed by the respondent, Dr. Michael Stevens, organizational behavior in Weber State University faculty. So they tell me they have a full session for us. I would like to leave about 10 minutes at the end for some Q&A. With that, Dr. Cornett.
Well, thank you. This should work reasonably well. My company is the company basically does two things, mainly right now consulting to biotech companies and music production. I'm actually producing an album of experimental jazz by Joel Forrester, who wrote the theme to Fresh Air, those of you NPR fans. It's a really great album. And then I'm producing a markedly inferior album of my own music, which is taking a lot longer because I'm...
Hold the mic, Mike.
Yeah, that wasn't recorded. Very nice. So I need to hold the mic? We will do that. I've written my remarks so that I could stay focused on track and try to make this fairly compact. If something becomes completely ambiguous and bizarre, by all means, raise your hand, and I'll try to explain it a bit. But let's try to work through this. All right. We should express my gratitude to symposium organizers for this opportunity and to Dr. Stevens for responding. I've been watching Dr. Stevens' activities for a while as a guy that's at a business school and involved with Sunstone. I actually appreciate that. You know, the typical Mormon mold is if you have an MBA, you've learned to let the senior executives think for you and, you know, so on and so forth, but Michael's a refreshing change from that. All right, let us start by defining two terms important to this paper. Dignity I define here as the capacity and right to achieve one's potential for happiness as a human being. I have for some time considered dignity to be the core value and objective of the LDS faith, as stated in Moses 1:39, "For behold, this is my work and my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man." Moral agency is defined as one's inherent ability, right, and responsibility to think critically in their moral judgment and to act accordingly. Exercise of moral agency has implications for upholding the dignity of others and self. Mormon tradition that Lucifer fell in Satan and became Satan after proposing a plan where individual moral agency would be surrendered to Lucifer's purported objective of universal salvation. That's the Mormon tradition, I think, we all grew up with. This LDS tradition, as taught to me in youth programs and so forth, continues that Lucifer's plan would have failed because individual moral agency is at some fundamental level either morally inviolable or inherently not amenable to total control. It has been demonstrated, however, that a large portion of individuals are willing to surrender their moral agency by obeying a purported authority or principle without adequate consideration of human dignity. I refer to this ascendance of obedience over dignity as obedience culture. Obedience culture has over the past decade driven substantial challenges to the moral, social, and political well-being of the U.S. This paper will argue that the LDS culture has played a disproportionately effective, efficient, and unfavorable role in exacerbating these challenges. An important learning reinforced in the 20th century experience, including the Holocaust and Stanley Milgram's subsequent efforts to explain it, is that it is possible to create an obedience culture where obedience takes priority over dignity, where individual moral agency is apparently subjugated by a majority of constituents to an institution or an ideology. Milgram refers to the Holocaust as a case of destructive obedience, where he says, Corpses were produced with the same efficiency as the manufacture of appliances. These inhumane policies may have originated in the mind of a single person, but they could only be carried out on a massive scale if a very large number of persons obeyed orders. We will now turn to a few examples of recent unfavorable incidents brought on by obedience culture. Constituents of a rigid obedience culture religion community carried out the acts of September 11th. In general, obedience culture may start as the enemy of civil discourse, whether it is one's own church or in a Saudi-financed madrasas. Ultimately, obedience culture strives to suppress dignity and the individual in the name of obedience and the institution, whether it ostracizes some of the best scholars in our church, brings down the World Trade Center in New York, or results in the torture of prisoners under U.S. custody. In the words of Heinrich Heine, that was mere foreplay. Where they have burned books, they will end in burning human beings. On the domestic front, consider possibly illegal. By the way, this is the most disturbing slide, so I see people leaving, which is fine. But I don't like looking at this slide myself. I have the privilege of looking at the paper. All right. On the domestic front, consider possibly illegal, ostensibly aberrant politicization of the firings of U.S. attorneys, fundamental counter-constitutional efforts of the White House to expand domestic surveillance authority and operations over the strong objections of then-Attorney General Ashcroft, not always considered to be the most fierce advocate of civil liberties, and the head of the FBI. What do all these obedience culture examples have in common? They have in common the ascendancy of obedience over dignity. Oh, look, we're, sorry, I think we're a bit off here. Here we go, thank you. They have in common the ascendance of obedience over dignity. They rank certainty and unquestioning faith above critical thinking and loyalty over competence. There's also a tendency to rely upon demagoguery, fear, and self-righteousness rather than hope, optimism, and cultural humility. In this paper, I will introduce ideas from complexity science in order to give a fresh perspective on obedience culture. Next, I will discuss the spread of obedience culture in the U.S., first during the 1990s in a number of U.S. churches, including ours, then during the current decade in the recent Bush administration. A central issue is that recent severe compromise of the U.S. government's ability to provide moral leadership at home and abroad, and that this has come directly as a result from obedience cultures in indigenous U.S. churches. We then will examine the LDS Church's pivotal role in the passage of California's Prop 8 and the resultant popular backlash, closing with possible responses to the current situation. Speaking simply, complexity science is the study of what emerges from systems with many interacting components. Over the past three decades, the field has grown from small outposts of ivory tower dwellers in places like Santa Cruz and Los Alamos into prominence across a broader array of fields, ranging from trading of sophisticated financial derivatives and characterizations of biological processes to the advancements recently in managerial and political science. Principles and insights from the discipline have had significant effect upon my approach to a number of arenas, including business, politics, and more recently, the ascendance of obedience culture in the LDS Church. I have become more concerned as I have seen national-scale parallels among some larger Protestant churches. Let's discuss briefly a couple principles here. First, that of robustness, which means the ability to remain viable in the context of a challenging, dynamic environment. Importantly, robustness does not equate unequivocally to strength. A vast number of large, strong species, dinosaurs come to mind, are now extinct because they could not respond robustly to their environment. Despite their appreciable muscle mass and ability at times to deploy it during direct confrontations with other organisms. Be strong, be wrong tends not to be a robust survival strategy over the long term. It also can be a bad basis for foreign policy. A basic finding of complexity science is that large systems controlled overwhelmingly on a centralized global basis tend not to be robust in the face of dynamic challenges. One example from our culture, of course, is the view that Satan's doomed-to-failure plan relied too heavily on centralized hierarchical control. Instead, Christ's more autonomy-balanced and more robust model worn out. Conversely, reasonable autonomy of individual actors tends to allow for emergent bottom-up production of more robust responses to complex dynamic challenges. In other words, a system tends to find better solutions in challenging, turbulent situations when significant autonomy of individual agents is allowed. In a moral context, this would look to individual agency and open communication rather than centrally dictated, closely controlled actions for a robust response to moral challenges. Joseph Smith's "I teach them correct principles and they govern themselves" comes to mind. Another principle involves allowing data, knowledge, and learning to propagate throughout a system, not just from the top-down correlation style, but also from the bottom up and across networks of local and distant peers. Centrally dictated correlation committees tend not to foster this sort of robust, adaptive, and intelligent behavior. I've been taught in the LDS Church that the best form of government would be benevolent dictatorship, and that the only risk in establishing such would be the tendency of power to corrupt. In fact, let's go to Mosiah 29:13. And this is Benjamin's address, considered by many to be one of the seminal passages in the Book of Mormon, and I think it has some great points. This it is not one of them. Therefore, if it were possible that you could have just men to be your kings who would establish the laws of God and judge this people according to his commandments, yea, if you could have men for your kings who would do even as my father Benjamin did for this people, I say unto you, if this could always be the case, then it would be expedient that you should always have kings to rule over you. In the words of Mark Twain, there is nothing the matter with this except that it ain't so. What my LDS colleagues and I failed to realize or at least articulate was that dictatorships and other forms of rigid hierarchy tend not only to be malevolent but also inadequate, and the word stupid can come to mind, because their structure and function are antithetical to meeting complex challenges effectively. Let me also introduce the concept of being anti-qualified, an ostensibly new term coined for application here. The term anti-qualified is distinct from unqualified, which really means not qualified to a certain task, or lacking requisite characteristics for a certain role, responsibility, or objective. For example, a scarecrow is unqualified to protect a henhouse because it lacks critical capabilities such as detection and countering of threats to the well-being of poultry. Anti-qualified, however, means possessing characteristics that are actively antithetical to a particular role, responsibility, or objective. For example, a fox is anti-qualified to protect a henhouse because it has critical characteristics, namely propensities to kill and eat chickens, hens, and roosters, that work actively and directly against the purportedly principal priority of poultry protection. Complexity science would lead us to infer that rigid centralized hierarchy renders institutions as anti-qualified for addressing complex legal, social, and moral issues, particularly in a public arena where a heterogeneous group of agents are charged with arriving at robust solutions and accommodation strategies, if you will, in the context of shifting socio-political landscapes. Now let us examine obedience culture through the lens of complexity science. In the context of a challenging dynamic environment, the sacrifice of human dignity to institutional obedience decreases the very autonomy necessary to arrive at robust adaptive responses to emerging threats. Displacement of critical thinking by certainty and unflinching faith compromises the quality of reaction to important challenges. Priority of loyalty over competence puts the wrong people in positions of power and influence, thereby hindering both the formulation and execution of strategy. It is therefore reasonable to expect that churches driven by an obedience culture are likely to do more harm than good if they are influential in an increasingly complex, dynamic, heterogeneous milieu. This is exactly what has happened this decade. Let us now examine obedience culture in the ecclesiastical domain. As an example of Catholics versus LDS and intellectual autonomy, consider the following. Now, shortly after the election of Cardinal Ratzinger of Pope, I was at a business meeting in Italy where one of the executives somewhat sardonically noted that, finally, a pope would be bringing certainty to religious experience, something they had been all searching for decades. I also heard a similar remark from a complete stranger sitting across the aisle from me on a flight into Italy when the pope's election was announced. Here's a culture that clearly is not overwhelmed by certainty and thinking they're right all the time, based on at least these experiences. In contrast, I have yet to be in a normative community situation where a fellow Mormon questions statements such as the following from one of Gordon B. Hinckley's General Conference addresses. Certitude, which I define as complete and total assurance, is not the enemy of religion. It is of its very essence. Without certitude on the part of believers, a religious cause becomes soft, without muscle, without the driving force that would broaden its influence and capture the hearts and affections of men and women. This distinction between Catholic and LDS cultures was underscored recently when San Francisco's Roman Catholic Archbishop George Niederauer approached LDS church leadership for assistance in passing California's Prop 8. Now, over 30% of Californians are Catholic, while only 2% are LDS. Why then did the Catholics think they needed help from the Mormons? I would suggest that the Mormon Church's obedience culture, driven by the sort of differential certitude described above, provides an effective vehicle for conducting grassroots operations and mobilizing funds from its members. This was not lost on the Catholic leaderships, whose constituents, on average, over the past couple millennia, have learned not to take their church so seriously. And recently I've been disappointed by initially authoritarian responses to the proliferation of child abuse scandals. Catholic Archbishop Niederauer made a good bet here. Passage of Prop 8 was facilitated by an extraordinary contribution of time and money that far exceeded that given by any other religious community. By some estimates, contributions from LDS supporters accounted for a 45 to 55% of the roughly $40 million raised by the SNA campaign. More than 75% of the zip code supervisors in charge of canvassing and polling grassroots activities were LDS, and all of the regional supervisors were LDS. One memo, this is from WikiLeaks, that very, very naughty website. One memo released to local LDS leaders mentioned that there was not much grassroots participation from non-LDS people and that the success of Proposition 8 depended on the LDS community. The LDS Church's obedience culture, with its emphasis on centrality and loyalty, drove its ability to get a very large number of people to obey suggestions given in the context of a purported moral authority and was a decisive factor in the passage of California's Proposition 8. In an ABC News interview televised on my birthday this year, I was a very, very nice birthday person, Apostle Russell Ballard, discussed the church's operational effectiveness in Prop 8. He stated that when something needs to be done, we know how to do it, and that when the leadership of the church asks us to do something, we get it done. Again, obedience culture can be impressively efficient in executing tasks that require the cooperation from large numbers of people. The LDS Church's successful grassroots political activity in Prop 8 is a shining example, if you will. A glaring one, because this effectiveness surprised and overwhelmed those against Proposition 8, which was trailing significantly in the polls until the LDS grassroots campaign took to the streets in force. My experience has evidenced a clear trajectory of obedience culture ascendance in the LDS Church. For instance, my first exposure to Sunstone was in 1979, during my first semester at BYU. A flyer on the honors reading room at the Harold Beatty Library said, "If all the important questions have been answered for you, then Sunstone isn't for you." And I personally at the time was, gearing up all psyched up to go on a mission, and I thought, what a nice sentiment. I think for me all the questions have been answered, the important questions. But it's nice that other people are exploring and that they have this means to explore. I guess the answers for me at least have become a bit more complex over the years, and which is, of course, why I come here now, because I actually decided maybe I need a forum like this. All right. At that time, the church and BYU in particular was, to me, a place to examine, question, refine, and strengthen my faith and understanding. The church, however, seemed to have other plans. During the decade after my graduation from BYU, Dallin H. Oaks gave his 1989 Alternative Voices address, the first presidency issued its 1991 statement on symposia, and during my final year of school in 1993, the church disciplined the September 6th. The climate had changed radically. When I finished at BYU in 1985, my friends were preparing for graduate school and continuing to grow in the church. By the time I finished medical and graduate school in 1994, my friends were growing in their careers, but many were leaving the church, largely due to the suppression of civil discourse. Of my closer LDS friends with graduate degrees, roughly half are now completely out of the church, which, by the way, might explain why we still have this very strong skewing versus other cultures, as mentioned by the Pew data we saw last hour, for those of you who are here, that more educated people in the LDS faith tend to be more Orthodox, not less Orthodox. That's in stark contrast to the majority of religious adherents in the U.S. A very interesting phenomenon, actually. All right, while on the editorial board of Dialogue later in the 90s, I discovered how dramatic and successful, if you will, the church had been in suppressing civil discourse. Many of the people best qualified to contribute to Dialogue declined because they feared reprisals. This was particularly true of faculty at BYU, where I at one point spent a deal of time on campus visiting faculty in their offices. There was a near-universal reluctance to contribute on grounds of career ambition, as in, you know, keeping your jobs, not being fired. Other competent individuals declined to contribute because they believed that the church had so marginalized and decimated the dialogue community that their own scholarly efforts were best spent elsewhere. This dynamic of increased suppression of civil discourse, executed unidirectionally and downward from the highest offices, marks a clear trajectory of obedience culture ascendance in the LDS Church. This dynamic has also emerged forcibly in other cultures that have in turn decreased the quality of civil discourse and liberties in the public arena. As a result, these churches work against the human potentiality they ostensibly were established to support. As an example of counterproductive effort and influence of ecclesiastical obedience culture, I would cite the activity of the LDS Church and several other churches in support of banning same-sex marriage. This activity against same-sex marriage has been strongly pursued despite reasonable standards of tolerance and fairness. Supporting this view of obedience culture influence on public policy is the fact that only the only states with anti-sodomy laws still on the books. These data are a couple of years old now, at the time were ostensibly correct. Only states with anti-sodomy laws still on the books were either in the Bible Belt or in the LDS stronghold states of Idaho and Utah. Idaho and Utah are the only two states that actually have a plurality of adherents that are LDS. Not only does this activity against same-sex marriage come across as mean-spirited and decidedly unchristian to many of us, the message that homosexual preferences and relationships materially threaten the fabric of family and society also appears baseless, irresponsible, and downright silly. These purportedly Christian activists claiming to be defenders of the family are completely skirting, as it were, the principal threat. The principal sex-related threat to marriage obviously is not homosexual distraction of any sort, but rather extramarital heterosexual distraction. You know, I spend about a third of my time in an apartment in the West Village in New York City now, and I'm still straight. Okay, it's not the threat. Of course, expecting our Congress to pass legislation that discourages irresponsible, inconsiderate heterosexual behavior is akin to asking a Congress of foxes democratically elected by all voting adult foxes to draft and pass the Comprehensive Poultry Protection Act. While the religious right has been effective in galvanizing and consolidating many of its true believers with the sort of parochializing, fear-mongering activity characteristic of the heterosex is best a social agenda campaigns, the religious right has also been effective, unintentionally one would think, in making itself less relevant to and less able to engage with the civil society. For example, on the 16th of June 2006 edition of ABC's Sunday Morning News Show, there was discussion of the then-expected and now-executed presidential veto of the stem cell bill. Even George Will remarked that the public swing voter view of the Republican Party due to religious right influence was that, quote, this is a party of religious incompatibility with science. I had formerly thought that the ascendancy of obedience culture in the LDS Church and the active direct suppression of civil discourse by LDS leaders to be a phenomenon unimportant on a larger scale, that it was important to me only because I was one of a few hundred or maybe a few thousand LDS eccentrics who actually cared much about these things. I had surmised that the rest of the 10 million plus members of the LDS Church were oblivious or dismissive of these issues, and that this sort of vindictive authoritarian behavior and its attendant lack of response from an increasingly obedience-driven constituency had virtually no impact on the 300 million citizens of my country, let alone the larger world. So I thought, you know, tempest in a teapot, stop complaining. But I was wrong. The obedience culture that had gained dominance in my church had in parallel fashion taken hold of larger socially conservative churches, including the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S. The aggregate obedience culture of these churches has been forcibly injected into the Bush White House, and with it an ethos that has had devastating consequences on this nation's ability to provide moral leadership at home and abroad. At home, fundamental civil liberties have been inappropriately compromised by the Patriot Act and other measures in the name of a conflict labeled as the War on Terror. Abroad, the invasion of Iraq has decreased this country's popularity, and further significant damages has been brought by the use of rendition, torture, and other irregular practices generally considered unacceptable in civil society. This has catastrophically reduced our credibility and effectiveness as advocates of freedom, fairness, humanity, and dignity. Obedience culture has actively fostered all of these developments. The new president has a global scale diplomatic mess to clean up, and that mess is a direct result of the obedience culture fostered and expanded in my church and other socially conservative institutions. Influence of the LDS Church's indigenous obedience culture was frightfully evident during the recent Bush administration. Jay Bybee, the torture memo author, is LDS, as is BYU graduate Kyle Simpson, who resigned as chief of staff to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez during the escalation of the U.S. prosecutor filing scandal. Another example involves additions to language in the Patriot Act that have made it easier to replace U.S. attorneys with reduced congressional oversight, in general compromising the balance of powers that the Constitution was carefully designed to uphold. This language has received extensive scrutiny in the subsequent and ensuing Senate investigations. In a February 6 meeting, 2007, Arlen Specter, who had been chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee when the Patriot Act was first drafted and passed, explained the tracing and inclusion of said language. I then contacted my very able chief counsel, Michael O'Neill, to find out exactly what had happened. And Mr. O'Neill advised me that the requested change had come from the Department of Justice, that it had been handled by Brett Tolman, who is now the U.S. Attorney for Utah, and that the change had been requested by the Department of Justice because there had been difficulty with the replacement of a U.S. attorney in South Dakota. Both Michael O'Neill and Brett Tolman are U.S. graduates of BYU, LDS graduates of BYU. Although LDS obedience culture arguably has played a disproportionately large and unfavorable role in the shortcomings and misdeeds of the recent administration, the overall obedience culture problem is a much larger phenomenon. We will turn to the example of the largest U.S. Protestant denomination, the Southern Baptist Convention. When former U.S. President Jimmy Carter attends an evangelical church, where he regularly teaches Bible study classes. He recently wrote a book called Our Endangered Values. One casually familiar with Jimmy Carter's evangelical background might expect the book to talk about Hollywood and rampant sex on the screen and all that. Instead, it's a very different story he's telling. It provides a critical and an unfavorable overview of the increasingly rigid hierarchy of the religious right and the associated stifling of civil society it has spawned in government and elsewhere. Here are some excerpts. Americans cherish the greatness of our homeland, but many do not realize how extensive and profound are the transformations that are now taking place in our nation's basic moral values, public discourse, and political philosophy. With the most diverse and innovative population on Earth, we have learned the value of providing our citizens with accurate information, treating dissenting voices and beliefs with respect, and accommodating free and open debate on controversial issues. Most of our political leaders have extolled state and local autonomy, preserved the separation of church and state, and protected civil liberties and personal privacy. All of these historic commitments are now being challenged. In his book, Jimmy Carter expresses concerns about changes in his own church and several other denominations. President Carter and his wife formally dissociated from the Southern Baptist Convention in protest of the organization's increasingly strident and rigid fundamentalism and hierarchy. They still, however, attend the same congregation, and President Carter still teaches Bible classes there. This is a superb example of protest in the context of continued engagement. From a reading of former President Carter's book, one reasonably infers that an appreciable portion of the Baptist community has been systematically centralized, parochialized, and dogmatized. This should sound familiar to us. But this systematic suppression of civil discourse we have been witnessing up close and personal in the LDS community has been occurring on a much larger scale in the largest Protestant community in the U.S., as well as in other churches that form the core constituency of the religious right in this country. This spreading of obedience, the spreading influence has culminated in a recent U.S. presidential administration whose obedience culture ethos was alarmingly out of step with national needs and geopolitical dynamics. I share here another quote from Jimmy Carter's book. There has been indeed a disturbing trend toward fundamentalism in recent years among political leaders and within major religious groups both abroad and in our country, and they have become increasingly intertwined. So where has the obedience culture of the recent Bush administration taken us? based on a decision process in which civil discourse was clearly discouraged and fearful adherence to a preconceived agenda was forcefully encouraged. We have again invaded Iraq, our picking of a tab estimated at $3 trillion, and have a significantly decreased credibility in the context of formulation and implementation of solutions to serious problems, such as in Iran with a pending nuclear weapons capability. Our country's credibility has been materially compromised in the scientific community as well. In a public forum, Robert May, the president of Britain's Royal Society, roughly equivalent to our National Academy of Sciences, responded to the current Bush now past Bush administration's efforts in downplaying global warming and rejecting international standards. He said the Bush administration is resisting scientific fact and is trying to superimpose one fundamentalist ideology on the rest of the G8. Where has obedience culture taken the LDS Church? Its pivotal support of California's Proposition 8 has perhaps garnered some grudging acknowledgement and affirmation from other obedience culture churches. Those in church PR, however, are perhaps thinking this to be outweighed by the magnitude and breadth of negative response spanning from California to New York and elsewhere. In California, the Los Angeles Temple, where I was married 20 years ago, has been confronted with multiple protests, and prominent LDS members of the arts community have been pressured into resigning from their positions. In Manhattan, far from the focus of the church's Prop 8 activity, 8,000 people protested at the LDS Temple. At one of these, Don Alden, a BYU graduate who now defines himself as a gay atheist Mormon, wore a memorable t-shirt saying, "Don't hate me because I'm queer. Hate me because I am Mormon." Some people took this the wrong way. He was just trying to make a joke and point out the irony, I guess, of the fact, on the one hand, that Mormons have historically been persecuted and marginalized, and now our church is ostensibly very actively engaged in doing the same thing to the gay community. Personally, I have become concerned that my tithing donations are building a church that has had such a negative political impact, and I am wondering if it were more consistent with my morals to put the funds elsewhere, despite the church's impressive contributions in the realms of humanitarian service and so forth. I expect that others share these concerns. Well, it's time to wind up here. This paper is taking the following positions. Firstly, structural and functional characteristics of obedience culture-driven churches such as ours render them as anti-qualified, as principal public policy influencers. Secondly, given the clear choices obedience culture-driven churches have made to operate outside the ethical constraints of civil society, it is inappropriate and arguably hypocritical for them to pretend to or expect to participate as fully credible actors in civil society. Thirdly, the growing political influence of obedience culture churches in the U.S. and by their Islamist counterparts abroad has materially compromised human dignity and this country's moral status on the global stage. The inauguration of President Obama offers hope, but much damage has been done. Fourthly, the LDS Church's direct and pivotal role in passing California's Proposition 8 has demonstrated the force and impact of obedience culture in what was the most heavily funded campaign outside the presidential race in November 2008. Resultantly, there has been a widespread response of revulsion to the power of the church's obedience culture and its political influence. So I've been complaining, haven't I? What should we do? Obedience culture has backfired in the national political arena, and it has also turned upon its proponents in the social domain as well. Those of us in the LDS community are dealing with Prop 8 backlash from civil society and from some uncivil sectors of society as well. Some Mormons who have done no more than participate legitimately in the political process are dealing with job loss and discrimination, particularly in the artistic community. In general, Mormons are being branded as homophobic right-wing nutjobs and socially destructive idiots. So many words. And the community's ability to have favorable social impact is most likely diminished due to increased rancor and decreased credibility. In this light, I have an immodest proposal. It stands that the LDS Church leadership in Salt Lake City and elsewhere has the authoritarian scope to prescribe to some degree the nature of discourse, such as it is, within the walls of LDS chapels by a correlation, general broadcasts, selections of Sunday school teachers, and so forth. These church leaders also have vested in them the power to dictate the membership status of constituents via baptismal qualification, bishops' interviews, church courts, and so forth. LDS Church leadership possesses, however, neither the power nor the right to absolve individuals of their moral agency, which, last time I checked, involved thinking for oneself and acting with integrity. Furthermore, church leaders can recommend but cannot dictate the nature of discussions among members conducted outside of official meetings. The ostensibly naive hope... How much time do I have left? Where are we?
You've got plenty.
All right.
You're ahead of yourself.
I am?
You're ahead of your slide.
Thank you. So here we go. So the ostensibly naive hope here is that a productive counterbalance can emerge to the centrally driven obedience culture that has had such a negative effect, first on our church and then on our country over the past two decades. I'm not advocating rebellion within the church. I'm instead suggesting that a platform for civil discourse and social engagement for a broader LDS community needs to be fostered outside of the official proceedings of the church, where civil discourse is now prohibitively constrained and many who have much to contribute no longer feel welcome. The internet has worked somewhat to this end already. Blogs, discussion boards, etc. have begun to portray a more accurate picture of an LDS community that is neither homogenous in its living nor uncritical in its thinking. These environments, however, tend principally to cater internally to specific segments of the active or inactive LDS community. Suggested here is a coalition of active and inactive Mormons designed principally to communicate externally. Now, I recall a recent experience where a client who was a secular Jew but son of an Orthodox rabbi took me to a UJF, United Jewish Fund, dinner. And there were a great span of people that clearly were Orthodox based on their dress, and people that clearly were secular based on, you know, direct conversations with some of these people. But they were all sitting in the same room together talking about how they can have a favorable impact on their community, how they can raise funds and donate time for those less fortunate. We don't have that sort of platform in our community right now. What we have is a church that's very effective in its organization. But with that organizational effectiveness, again, has come a circumscription of what should be of appropriate civil discourse. So what one would like to see, I would think, would be some external face of the LDS community that is not official, that's not trying to toe some correlation line, but rather portrays a face of what message could be, we're not right-wing nut job homophobes. Right? You'd be a bit more subtle about it. But that message needs to go out there. I continually run into people who say, you know, look at me and say, you're Mormon, but you're not a right-wing nut job or whatever. You're not an idiot. You can pick it. You know, you're not a homophobe. This is a conversation. It's good that these conversations happen because it's showing that people are open-minded. But you'd prefer that the conversation started out like, you know, I know there's a vast diversity of people in your church and that they're all not right-wing nut jobs and you're probably not one of them. Right? So that's fine. That's where we'd like to be. We're not there. Can we organize a community that does that? Maybe. I've started having some conversations. I spend about a third of my time in the East Coast and two-thirds in the West Coast. So I've been spending a lot of time in those evil blue states trying to formulate some ideas with some input from some very wonderful people. And anyone here that's interested in trying to put together some sort of community, externally facing community, if you will, just talk to me afterwards. I'd be very happy to work on that. All right. Ultimately, we should be able to show the larger world a broader LDS community, less compromised by obedience culture, and more focused on fostering dignity. That is, achieving our potential as human beings, which is what I thought my church was about in the first place. Thanks.
Okay, well, a lot of this won't, in fact, be faring away, but will be a...
You're a professor. You have to
a demonstration of like-minded... Well, that's true, a professor. And my first observation is to say, wow, all that from a medical doctor, not bad. Then I realized Glenn also has a PhD, so okay, well, that makes sense.
I have a real doctorate, yes.
Yeah, a real doctor. So, hey, I'm a I'm a business professor. I can't throw stones when you live in a moral glass house, right? So I got to be careful. There is one a counterposition that I would add to Glenn's treatise this afternoon. Not so much as a refutation, but more as a broader juxtaposition. And that is there is most definitely a role and a place and a space for obedience within Mormonism, within the gospel, within any kind of organizational life. The notion of obedience, I think, is embedded in much of the biblical tradition and what Jesus was fighting against in the New Testament when he came up against the law of Moses. Over and over again, he was criticized himself for not being obedient. Why was he not following the prescriptions of the law of Moses? Why were you eating with all these people? The law says you can't. You're being disobedient. You know, why are you not washing your hands? Why are you not doing all the kosher things you're supposed to be? You're heretical. You're obedient. And of course, his response was not to throw out or to dismiss the law of Moses and obedience as such, but to put it in a proper context. And that's why we're taught that obedience, like the law of Moses, is a schoolmaster. And many of us, whether you believe it or not, you've certainly heard within Mormon culture that the first law of heaven is what?
Obedience.
Charity, right?
Love.
And love. Ah, but how many of you said obedience? Okay, I've heard that over and over and over again, all right? But the question is, are you talking about first in terms of preeminence or first in terms of chronology? Okay, the first grade, like kindergarten, first grade, and so on, the first grade is the first grade. Not in preeminence, but in chronology. So if you go to the first grade, you finish that class, you go, hey, I've done it, I've reached the top. First grade, we got it completely backwards. Right? The first grade is the first step on a journey, just like in the world of music. You know, I have a daughter who's very artistically inclined. She took years and years of classical piano training, and early on, the only thing I remember is scales. Up and down the piano, just scales. And y'all know what those are, right? Okay, and the idea behind scales is what? They are training. They're indoctrination. They are inviolate. You play the scales the way they're supposed to be played so that you become obedient and submissive. Well, that's not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to master your technique and to focus and harness your gift so that when the time comes and you're moved upon by the Spirit or by tuition or by creative innovation, you have the mastery to move on and create, you know, tremendous and beautiful music. So in a lot of ways, and in fact, visually, if you were to look at the way I would describe this interplay between obedience on the one hand, especially within an organizational context, and the paradox or antithesis to that, which is creativity and innovation, you can go back to what many of us have seen or what many of us visualize when we think of organizational hierarchy. Visually, what do we see? We see an organizational chart, a pyramid with the point at the top and the broad base at the bottom. That is organization. That is system. That is how you control the chaos, the confusion, and all of the variants that will destroy the efficiencies and the ability of your organization to carry forward its mission. Of course, this is precisely what DNC 121 warns us against, that if we don't have that kind of organizational structure paired with or counterbalanced with the upside-down pyramid, which is described in Section 121 as what? Persuasion, love unfeigned, gentleness, meekness, long-suffering, and so on. If you don't have that obedience culture simultaneously met with the countervailing force mercy and compassion, you can end up in two very undesirable worlds. On the one, if you just have hierarchy and control, rules, policies, procedures, that very, very quickly devolves into oppression and coercion, in which you stifle creativity and innovation. But on the other hand, if you move towards the upside-down pyramid, without having established the capability of your organizational members for individual responsibility, so that when you empower them, they have the capacity to use that, you know, empowered state in a healthy, constructive, and collaborative way, you've got chaos. So how do you find the balance between the two? You throw one or the other out. Well, no, actually, what you get visually when you embrace this paradox of the organizational pyramid while simultaneously embracing the upside-down pyramid, you superimpose one upon the other, and you have what we all recognize as the symbol of the Jewish state, the Star of David, which actually is a symbol that has been co-opted in modern days by the Jewish nation, the Jewish state, but in fact is a symbol that goes back several millennia to the earliest rabbinic traditions, which was originally a symbol that represented the divine marriage between the female god and the male god. In other words, the yin and the yang. The balance between the two countervailing forces of organization, a structure, and systems on the one hand, with mercy, compassion on the other. So this juxtaposition between order and creation at an individual level is very difficult to find. You know, that unbalance in our own lives. When you don't find it individually, you know, we end up being guilty of the kind of concerns that DNC 121 warns us against: compulsion, unrighteous dominion, and so on. And when you can't do that, when you aggregate across lots of individuals in an organization where you don't have that, or where you can't find that at an individual level, it aggregates to the group level or the organizational level as this obedience culture, which, to a degree, has its place, but is a very, very risky business. And as DNC 121 warns us, it is the propensity of how many? Almost all men and women to exercise what little authority or power they have in a way that represents unrighteous dominion. So what kind of recommendations we have? Glenn identified several, I think, that are right on the money, would be very helpful. I would also add one of my own. To most of us in here, I'm guessing it's probably more the case where, yes, as members of an organization that wants to keep all of us in the first grade, many of us have moved on to high school, even graduate school, and want to begin to think and exercise and take upon ourselves the kind of empowerment that, that the gospel promise holds out for us. We have a special obligation or burden, if you will, to make sure that we embrace the commandment of the physician, heal thyself. So that when it comes to the larger organization or institution of the church, yes, there are things that perhaps you and I would like to see change in terms of our culture. The reality of changing organizational culture is that that has to come from the top down. Yes, movements can bubble up from the grassroots, but in any organization, those grassroots efforts or movements will only survive and only thrive to the degree that the power brokers, the leadership of the hierarchy in the organization, sanction them and allow them and don't squash them. But at the same time, you and I have influence in, you know, our little corners of the world and our little corners of the church. So rather than worrying so much about whether or not the hierarchy of the church created an empowerment culture as opposed to an obedience culture throughout the organization, my challenge has always been to make sure that if I am an assistant nursery leader, I need to make sure that the nursery where I work and operate is as free from unrighteous dominion and coercion as I can make it. Now, granted...
Good luck in nursery, by the way.
I was going to say, now granted, when you're in nursery, that's precisely where the idea of protecting infants against themselves, because they don't have the maturity, they don't have the cognitive development to understand the reasons why. But as Paul tells us, as we mature, if you don't set away childish things, and if you, and yes, it's important to make sure that people are fed milk before meat, but what happens to a child is as it grows and matures physiologically, if you keep that infant on milk forever, what happens to the medical world? It's not a healthy state of affairs. So I often come to these Sunstone conferences in large measure because, like Glenn said, you know, if you're not finding the nourishment that you can at home, you know, it's okay to go out and find a good barbecue. And that's why I love coming to Sunstone. This is, for me, a gospel meat lovers convention, so welcome to the barbecue.
I can tell you lived in Texas for a while.
We have 10 minutes for questions and answers, and I think if we take
ask their questions into the mic, we can get them.
Questions into the mic.
Yeah.
Okay. So I get to be the...
Phil Donahue.
Yeah, Phil Donahue. Okay, I will take... I don't know who raised your hand first. We'll take the front row and then maybe a second.
Hi, I'm from Southern Virginia University. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Sure.
Right now, we're trying to create a Bill of Rights for more free thinking, but our problem is coming trying to convince those who aren't free thinking, who want to be obedient and who want to obey. So what kind of ideas? Do we just combat them with Scripture, or do we combat them? How do we debate it out?
Well, essentially, the question is, how do you fight power brokers when they're hell-bent on taking away your power? And the very act of answering a question proves the side of the debate that they're arguing, which is that you're rebellious, you're unrepentant, and you need to change. That's a very difficult dialogue, even in the most fair-minded secular world. When you introduce the trump card that you have to obey because God says you do, and you're debating with God, now all bets are off, right? So what do you do? Well, it's a very difficult position to be in. I have found some techniques that are helpful, like the Socratic method. But you have to start from a point of origin where you are willing to give these individuals the benefit of the doubt, to see them with love and compassion, to try to understand their position, their goals, their motives, their agenda, and then just try to work around it. And rather than fighting and combating, asking questions, when they quote a throughout mantra or euphemisms or misquote Scripture, try to engage in dialogue, ask for explanations. You know, for example, one of my favorites with the... whenever I hear the obedience is the first law of heaven, stop asking questions, like in Sunday school or quorum meetings, I say, well, you know what, let's read that in the Scriptures, see if we can put it into context. And then I'd sit quietly and wait for the person to open their Scriptures and turn to that passage.
Which doesn't exist, which is not a problem.
Which doesn't exist, and that's the point. And, you know, you let them squirm a little bit. And I don't do it out of like a chess move. Aha, see, I put you in the corner and I checkmated you. But to kind of help them along their journey to a realization that, well, okay, I've been quoting this passage all these years as if it were Scripture, and now when I try to look at it, gee, I really don't find it. Let them have their own epiphany. Just try to kind of orchestrate it that way. But in a lot of ways, now I can only speak from my own experience, which is that I had to go find a good barbecue somewhere else.
How about you? I think what you're doing is thrilling, first of all. I commend it. I get the impression that BYU has kind of clamped down on that effectively. Right? And that, to be fair, I haven't been there much for a while. But trying to put it together while you have a chance, and in fact, I've actually thought of your institution, wondering what they were doing about being open to, you know, just standard civil discourse that I enjoyed at University of Michigan, and so on and so forth, UCLA. One of the things I would do, very respectively, is just point out, you know, some of the things that I mentioned earlier, I suppose, the idea of agency, right, and that we're all moral agents and we need to govern ourselves. Without that, you can never be sure. You know, go to 2 Thessalonians 5, there's 21 and 22. The 21, yeah, prove all things, hold fast that which is good. You just say this is what we're told to do as converts. You know, probably half of us have patriarchal blessings that say we're out to help the honest in heart or something like that, right? Explain that part of being honest in heart is exploring the questions for yourself, and you may very well end up at the same answers that your right-wing nut job friends have after you consider it for a couple of years, but you're going to take your time getting there. Right, please.
And emphasizing commonalities also is important. You know,
yes.
One of the things that I've found with even the most orthodox and strident obedience members of the church is when they start, you know, demanding submission and obedience to every word that comes from every general authority, as if it were the personal opinion of Jesus Christ. I point out to them, okay, well, you and I are on the same page because we both are at least striving to become disciples of Christ, and to the degree that church leaders point me to Christ, then I'm on board with that. And they usually are going to nod and say, well, yes, that's true. And then if they're interested in further discussion, we can get into, well, are they really or are they really not? But in terms of agreement on central issues, that's often a place for commonality and common ground.
Okay. This is Neil.
I like your metaphor. It's elegant. It relies on common text that we all have. Well, I think it's too easy. And it brings up an argument I had with you this morning in an earlier session that I didn't get a chance to bring up, so I want to raise it. If you're running the nursery to run with the young children, and you need to do first grade, you need to do first grade.
Neil, get close to the mic.
If you're running the nursery, you're working with children, you need to do first grade, you need to do first grade. I agree with that. But if you're working with 14, 15, 16-year-olds, and somewhere in that group of kids, and maybe somebody is discovering your sexuality, and it's not your job here to be disobedient, to contradict what's just been said from the pulpit, and is being said from the pulpit, and so it's your business, the understanding, the scriptures, to refer to Christ, to be a nice guy, but not to create waves. Then, over this period of time, the prevailing notion, the one we're hearing from the pulpit, the one that's being propagated outside, creates damage. Lots of damage. And the damage is ongoing. And it's morally reprehensible. And today, within the church, and this is what we were talking about this morning, racism is still there. There are people in their minds still justify the policies and practices before, still think of the Negro, that was the term, black people now, as spiritually inferior in some sense, still practice prejudice because we have such a long history of doing that. And nobody's willing to speak out. Nobody's willing to say, well, obvious, our leaders were wrong. We made a bad mistake. Because that challenges the authority of the church. If we don't challenge the authority, and they're never going to challenge the authority, we create a lot of damage in the time we're sitting, teaching that class, knowing there may be somebody here who is suffering and will suffer from what they're hearing from the pulpit when we just understand.
Let me just respond real quickly. Actually, I do agree with you, and I'm not suggesting in any degree or measure a passive response to abuse when it's confronted. The question is, how do you respond to abuse? Do you respond to abuse with counterattack and coercion to shut down the abuser? If you do, then in the end, are your tactics really just tactics in kind? I have found, for example, one of the things that I want to abide in my priesthood lessons, I shouldn't say it's just being recorded, but he would never listen to it. We have, because it's a Sunstone take, but you know, I have a high group, high priest group where we've got an 80-plus-year-old brother, and I call him Brother Bunker, as in Archie Bunker fame. And some of the things he says are just beyond outrageous. And I often have to raise my hand and say, you know, Brother Bunker, is this really what Elder Nelson said in the conference talk that we're talking about, or is this kind of your own interpretation? And then that often kind of stops and gets things back on track. I mean, there are different ways of presenting. And one of the things that I also do in terms of the Socratic method is to test and size people up to see how willing they are to entertain a dialogue as opposed to try to overwhelm me with their counterarguments. So when we're in a Sunday school lesson and somebody says something like, you know, blacks were less valiant than the pre-existent, I will raise my hand and say, you know what, I'm not really sure I believe that. And then I just kind of hold the pause to see what kind of a reaction I get. You know, I get someone who just forges ahead and starts browbeating me to convince me that, you know, I'm just flat out wrong and I don't understand the history and the church doctrine and all the rest. That is pretty good signal to me that this is not someone who's interested in a conversation or a dialogue. And it takes patience to sit there and receive that kind of browbeating. But then when they finish, because they almost usually do, if there's still a pause and they wait for me to respond, I just say, you know what, I just don't think I believe that. And eventually they get tired of their browbeating, and they say, why don't you believe it? And then, okay, now I have an opening, and I can respond with examples or scriptures or whatever might be my position, but I have to be willing to grant to them the dignity and respect for their views that I insist that they have for mine.
Go ahead, please.
You may have to come down here. And by the way, this will have to be the last question. So for those of you who do have questions, besides this last one, I invite you to talk to the panelists right after.
I'm just curious your position and your thoughts, I guess. Because I think in my experience, there's a little bit of cognitive dissonance here, and I'm curious what your perspective is, because I have found that while we talk about beliefs, and obviously our church is a church, you know, we have beliefs, but we talk about our beliefs, but if any of us really have beliefs and conviction, that even if it's the exact same thing that what everyone else is talking about, it's threatening. Do you have thoughts about that?
Go ahead. Could you restate that question?
Sure. I'm not trying to be cryptic or anything, but yeah. For example, we talk about having the values of compassion and love for our fellow neighbors, mm-hmm. and we as a church espouse that belief, right? But when an individual has a very strong conviction and belief of love thy neighbor, whether it manifests itself in humane immigration policy like we heard about this morning or whatever it might be, that belief and conviction is threatening. Did you have a thought on that?
You get the final word. It's your presentation.
Oh, boy.
I'm sorry.
Okay, so let me see if I can parse this correctly. The assumption here is a context of what have you, concern for well-being of one's fellow men, but one has a materialist agreement on immigration policy, right? And how does one broach those differences?
Well, as an example, but yeah.
That's an example, wow. Well, part of my example is I'm still of two minds on it, and I spend a lot of time listening to other people because I know if I open my mouth, I'll disagree with it 3 months later. So, but in general, if someone's willing to engage on that basis that they're concerned for the well-being of their fellow men, and are trying to think through it, then you're probably heading in a good direction.
And I would just say the heart of pulling off what you're asking is the ability to engage in empathic listening and empathic conversations, which is beyond the scope of most people in what we call the real world, let alone an organizational culture